there's a fascinating subject that raises itself now, which is when the Torah discusses, we're now reading the section in the Torah, the beginning of the world, and we come to the story of Lot and his daughters, how the world actually got going. Sodom was destroyed, Avram Avinu had just begun the pathway that would lead to the Jewish people, and his nephew Lot, as I'm sure you remember, escaped with his life. His wife didn't survive, and he was with two daughters alone in a cave. You remember the incident. Now the Gemara says a very interesting thing, and it'll take some understanding. The Gemara says that this is what happened. That three of them were alone. The girls were under the impression that there were no men left alive, or that they were the last people alive on earth, and therefore if they would not get married, if they wouldn't be able to have children, then the end of the world would be, that would be the end of the world. They didn't know that there were people alive anywhere else. They thought they were the last people alive, and so they reasoned that the only way to keep the world going was to try and have children from their father. Right? As I'm sure you remember the story. And that's what they did. They made him drunk, and that's what they did. The Gemara, there's distinction between the first daughter and the second one. Lot wasn't to blame with the first one because he didn't know. He really was asleep and drunk, but by afterwards he did know, and therefore he should have taken precautions that at least it shouldn't happen again with his second daughter. And there's differences between the girls, because one of them used a she was, not only did she do such a thing that was, well, we'll have to see if it was right or wrong, but she went so far as to actually name the child according to the sin. She called him Moab. Moab means from my father. You know, that's very belittling. I mean, if you have to do such a thing, but at least not to actually call the child the name of. The other girl called the child Ammon, which is, doesn't mean necessarily, doesn't indicate that what happened. Later, you'll see that if you trace these two children in history, the girls being pregnant had these two children, they later became great nations, Ammon and Moab. And those two nations gave rise to very amazing people. Out of Ammon, out of Moab came Ruth, who was very, very great, really one of the greatest women who ever lived. She became the grandmother, the great-grandmother of King David. Not bad after such beginnings. Converted into Judaism, found her way into the Torah world, and became the forerunner of Mashiach. And she was merited, fantastic, she merited to make that step of greatness. She merited to sit around when her great-great-great-grandson, King Shlomo, was king. She merited to see his reign, 40 years of complete peace in the whole world. He had a special chair for her. She was still alive, Ruth. 3-4 generations later, she merited to see that. And out of the other girl, out of the other daughter came a nation called Ammon, and a woman came out of them called Naama, if I'm not mistaken. She married Shlomo, Shlomo Melech, and also fitted into that line. Two doves, I think it says, that came out of, or she was, anyway, the point is that that's what happened. Now that's not so easy to understand, how those beginnings led to that sort of conclusion, and that has to be studied separately. We'll just try and touch on it from one particular angle today. But one has to discuss separately, and I think we have a cassette of that subject, of how the Mashiach, he starts in such very strange beginnings and follows a course, we might have discussed it here even once a year ago or so, follows a course that is so strange throughout history. And a person, if you want to understand the subject fully, you must research that. Also, you can listen to the cassette. I think it's called Mashiach, the Hidden Flower, or something like that. I think that's the talk where we discuss this particular subject. But let's look more closely now at the incident itself. Here were these girls. Now, what exactly should be one's approach to such a subject? How should you think about such a thing? Here these girls are about, they're caught in a situation where they're convinced that the only way to save the world is to do this thing. Now, this sin that they're going to do with their father, that sin of incest, that's a terrible thing. That's one of the things a person has to die for rather than do. Now, that itself is a debate, because according to certain of the Rishonim, they have a big discussion about whether it's also forbidden to non-Jews. See, non-Jews aren't commanded in the same mitzvahs that we are. They have certain mitzvahs more strict than we do, much stricter. But some mitzvahs, they don't have any mitzvahs they don't have at all that we do. Some things we are stricter than them. Now, exactly which forms of immorality, man-woman relationships, are prohibited and are not. So the commentaries say, even those who say that it might not have been prohibited to them in the same way as it is to Jews, but the non-Jewish nations took it on. They accepted for themselves as a norm of morality that such relationships between a father and a daughter should not be allowed, and therefore they shouldn't have transgressed that, even at least that, and maybe much worse than that. On the other hand, they're caught in a situation where, you know, if they don't do this sin, that's the end of the world. Now, what should be one's approach to? So you have a very fascinating thing. The Gemara says on that incident, at least with the older daughter, the one who went first, at least with the older daughter, the Gemara says an incredible statement, and that's what we'd like to try and understand today. Let's just make an announcement before we start. That's not relevant to us today. Why we're studying it is to understand, when you learn Tanakh, is that women, and understand the actions of great women, who did things that are very problematic or very difficult to understand. First of all, let's just make an announcement right now at the beginning of the talk, for those who leave early, that we're not justified to do these kind of things today. And I'll try and point out why, exactly, and study it. But the Gemara says an incredible thing. In at least one place, the Gemara says that the action of that daughter comments about it the following thing. Gedola avera lishma mimitzvah shelo lishma. That's what the Gemara says. It is greater to do a sin for the right reason than a mitzvah for the wrong reason. Now, before you get carried away and run out and see where you can exactly start finding things that, you know, normally one isn't allowed to do because you've got something in mind that's a mitzvah. That's why I started off with the announcement, not relevant to us today. But let's try and study the subject and see maybe where it does touch on us today. You see, the problem is this. Let's approach it in systematic fashion. We're trying to understand here how it could be that a person can do something that's wrong against the Torah, a desperate prohibition that you have to give your life for, maybe. Examples even where you have to give your life rather than do it. The most serious prohibition. But because in this situation, Hashem really wants it, He's putting you to a tremendous ordeal. He wants you to transgress something that normally you'd have to give your life for, but in these circumstances He wants you to do. And for a great study, gets a tremendous ordeal. First part of your deal is figuring out whether it is or isn't such a situation. And secondly, it means bringing yourself to do something that normally is tremendously prohibited. With a desperate level of self-sacrifice that you have to give for that thing, and here you have to actually do it, and Hashem really wants it. Can you see how confusing this area is? Let's see if we can try and understand it. The way to approach it is as follows. Let's first state the case, and then we'll try and understand it. The Chaim Shulevitz used to say, he used to put it this way. I never was going to see him, but people who were present at his talks have told me, one person who was a student of his told me that he said the following thing. He said, the whole Torah is easy except for three things. That's what he said. The whole Torah is easy except for three things, which means keeping the Torah, the way he saw it, was easy. That means being tortured for Hashem's sake and dying for Hashem and everything the Torah wants you to do, that must, there's no problem at all. The only thing that's difficult are three areas in Torah, and they go around this subject that we're discussing now. The three areas are as follows. We'll try and discuss them as fully as we can, try and focus on the one that's our particular subject. The three areas are like this. One is called bituloi zehu kiyumoi, which means that sometimes negating a mitzvah is the way to do the mitzvah. Try and give examples. The second category is called Eis La'asos La'Hashem Hefer Torasecho. There are times in history when in order to do things for Hashem, we have to undo something that the Torah wants. We have to negate a Torah law in order to do the wrong thing, or override a Torah law in order to do something else that the Torah wants. We'll try and study this. And thirdly, this subject that's called Avera Lishmo. Avera Lishmo means a sin for the right reason, a sin for Hashem's sake, a sin that He really wants, a sin that's really a mitzvah in these circumstances. In other circumstances, it would be a terrible sin. Those are the three difficult things. This great man says that everything else is easy. But these three are difficult, and I'm sure you can see why. Now let's try and understand the subject. First of all, let's deal with the two categories that we mentioned, and then we'll come to the third one, which is our subject today. The first subject, the first of the three, which is called Bitulo Zerk Yumoi, which means sometimes you have to negate a mitzvah, override it, or not do it, let's say, in order to yes do it, to fulfill it, that does apply today. That does still apply today. When I can think of one or two simple examples, it would be like this. It means that sometimes a person is faced with a mitzvah, but the only way you can do that mitzvah is by not doing the mitzvah. That same mitzvah. Simple example would be like this. Let's say you're studying. Let's say a person is studying in yeshiva. And he gets to a point where he's so saturated or so tired, he has to take a break. So here he has to close the book. The whole point of what he's doing now is studying Torah, but he just can't absorb anymore. The only way he can carry on learning is if he takes a break. And it's a paradox. It means he's got to stop doing Hashem's mitzvah of learning his Torah. Why? Because if he would push himself and try and do the mitzvah more, he wouldn't do any of it. He wouldn't take any of it in. And therefore, he has to not do the mitzvah so he can be refreshed and go back. Of course, even this simple example, even this simple application is fraught with hazards, because your vested interests start telling you, you need a good rest now. That's what happens, you see. You've been concentrating for a few hours, and your Yetzer Hara tells you, you need a good 3-week break now. so that you can really get your batteries recharged. And of course it's very hard, and almost nobody can really get the borderline, can get that hair's breadth borderline, which is actually the accurate level. And you'll see, if you look around you, you'll see people who are working on themselves spiritually making mistakes all the time. You'll see those who over-rationalize, and they're taking breaks much more than they should. So the whole study thing consists of coffee breaks, a couple of minutes of pretense at doing the job. And there are other people who push themselves so hard that they crack. They overdo it. They should be taking a break, and they're overdoing it, and they push themselves to a point of no return. The Chofetz Chaim used to say that when it says in the evening davening that we ask Hashem not to put the Yetzer Hara in front of us or behind us. Hasaton lefaneinu v'acharenu, it says in the first bracha before Kriyat Shema in the evening. So what's the Yetzer Hara in front of you, and what's the Yetzer Hara behind you? What's the Satan that stands in front of you? So Chofetz Chaim used to say, beautiful, he used to say, the Satan, the Yetzer Hara, the negative inclination that stands in front of you, that's easy to understand. You're trying to go into the base medrash to serve Hashem, to learn Torah, he stands in front of you, he says, don't go in here. All other places you can go that are wonderful, and he keeps you out. Or you're going to do a mitzvah, he stands in front of you and blocks your way. That's easy. But what's the one that stands behind you? That's the one that says, no, go ahead, do a bit more, do a bit more. You can learn another hour a day. You can do an hour's less sleep. You can work on yourself with more self-restraint and more self-denial until finally you become you can become psychotic. Right? You can become zombied out and that's what he does. He knows he can destroy you. If you're very frum, he can't destroy you. A person who's got very frum motivation, he can't destroy him by telling him to stop. The person wouldn't hear that, but he can kill him just as well by telling him to keep going until the person drives himself into a spin and he can't get out of it. In fact, the Chofetz Chaim used to go around the yeshiva late at night putting out the lights. He used to go 11 o'clock at night, here were his boys. You can imagine that people at a very high level, these are people who went days without eating because there wasn't food. They used to eat a different family. Sometimes there wasn't a family to eat at. The yeshiva survived sometimes on a piece of toast and two cups of tea a day. People used to sleep on the benches in the yeshiva. I mean, people who really were giving up their lives for learning Torah. 11 o'clock at night, they got somewhere to put out all the lights. Because he said if they pushed themselves too hard, the people who were there, I've heard from them that as soon as he left, they used to put the lights out, used to carry on learning all night. But anyway, the point is, that's what he said. Well, I used to the light under the blanket. But the point is that, so therefore you have a concept, and of course it applies in general life also. If a person wants to get a job done, sometimes they need a break. That's the only justification, by the way, in Torah thinking for holidays. You don't find out you have a holiday in Torah. Where in Tanakh does it say somebody took a holiday? Where does it say that? Doesn't say that anyway. Where do you get the justification for taking a vacation? Doesn't say that. And it's also the justification for having a sleep. When a person goes to sleep at night, you're wasting, actually, a large proportion of your life sleeping. Those hours will never come again. What would a person at the end of his life give for another 8 hours? And you spent those 8 hours unconscious over and over and over. But of course the justification is that you have to do it because you won't achieve much the next day after 1 or 2 days without sleeping. And therefore, unfortunately, not unfortunately, that's the way the world's set up. In order to achieve, you have to step out of it and recharge and then go there. So that's a mitzvah, that's a concept of negating a mitzvah, which, in order to fulfill the mitzvah, which does apply today, there are countless examples. The difficulty with it is, and that's why Reb Chaim said it's difficult, is actually catching yourself at the right point where you're not overdoing the break, but you're not overdoing the effort as well. That's relatively easy to understand. Now the next category is called Eis Lasis Lashem Heferu Ferasecha. A time to do for Hashem, we have to undo your Torah, as it were. There are two ways to translate it, by the way. One translation is that it is a time to do for Hashem because they have trampled on your Torah, because they have negated your Torah. You follow? In other words, it's now a time that we have to act in a radical way for Hashem because people have negated your Torah. And there are examples of that. There were times in Jewish history where the Sanhedrin, Jewish leaders, they enacted laws much stricter than were necessary for that particular infringement because it was the beginning of a slippery slope towards doing things much worse. And therefore they put severe punishments on things that normally didn't have to be punished that severely in order to prevent people doing, you follow, going beyond what they should have. There's another translation of that phrase, which means not that it's a time to do for Hashem because they've trampled on your Torah, quite the opposite. It's a time to do radical things for Hashem now and trample on the Torah ourselves, as it were. In other words, we ourselves now must undo a law of the Torah. These two overlap, of course, these two ideas. We now ourselves must undo something that the Torah wants us to keep, because in this circumstance Hashem actually wants us to do it differently. You can see it's a very, very difficult thing. The classic example that I can think of is as follows. It says that when Hashem gave the Torah, he gave the written law, the Chumash, but he also gave the oral law. The precondition of giving us the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, was that it would never be written down. It was never allowed to be written down because it wouldn't be oral anymore. And he wanted it to be imprinted in the hearts and minds of the sages of each generation, of the Jews who study it, that it should be a thing in our consciousness and not something committed to paper and frozen that would kill it. And therefore you never were allowed to write it down. But it came, the generation of Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, who lived about 1700 years ago, second century, the common era more or less, and he had the terrible ordeal of having to decide what to do, because the oral law now was being forgotten. It was people were weak enough already that they didn't remember it perfectly, and certain cracks and fractures were creeping in, and the only way that he could stop that problem was to write it down. On the other hand, you weren't allowed to write it down. So it says that, that's where it says, Eis la'asas l'Hashem, he decided, he had the greatness to decide, that this was a time when Hashem really wants us now to undo that concept and to do it in a different way, and that would be the way to do it. Incredible thing. And he wrote it down. He wrote down the Mishnah. Of course, if you go into it, you'll see it's much deeper than that. I haven't got time to go into that now. Because he actually wrote down the Mishnah in such a way that retains its oral nature. That was his solution. He wrote the Mishnah in such a way that it actually codifies the words, that freezes the, all information is there, but without a teacher, without a Rebbe, and without the oral human component, you never can extract out of Mishnah. If you take a Mishnah and you try and read it, you'll get a tiny drop in the ocean out of what it's trying to say. You need the oral component. So he had a genius solution, which was to write down so much that it wouldn't be lost anymore, but in such a way that it still remains oral. But nevertheless, he still had to do that enormous landmark step of writing down something. And the second example of it is very similar. 200 years later, Ravina and Ravashi wrote the Gemara down. They wrote the Gemara. Even though that was the essence of the oral law, the discussion of the understanding of the Mishnah, they had wrote it down, because without that it would have been forgotten. But again, they used the same trick, the same solution, that they codified it in such a way that it is written, but without a teacher you can't understand. Anybody who can translate, anybody who knows enough Aramaic to translate a piece of Gemara accurately will realize that translating it doesn't help. Once you translate it, they have all the words. There was they say that the great Gentile scholar Albright was studying in the Chicago Museum once in America, and he was trying to fathom a piece of Talmud, the non-Jewish mind. And he had experts in ancient languages, and he had translated the page 100% accurately, and he was working on it for hours. And after a while, he went over to a young rabbinical student, the yeshiva bacher, who was sitting there, and he said, "Listen, do me a favor. Can you help me? I understand this page. I've translated this page absolutely accurately, and I've been working on it for hours, and I haven't got a clue what it's talking about." Of course, they couldn't explain it to him either, even with explanation. But that's another thing. But the point is that that's how they did it. Now, that's the principle of an unusual time to do things for Hashem, and we now have to do things that normally wouldn't be allowed. Of course, this category we're not able to do anymore, because we can't, yes, we don't know when we can pervert, let's say, the means in order to just justify the end. Now, we'll discuss more about this. Now, let's see the third category, and this is the one that we started with. Lot's daughter did something that is called an Avera Lishmo. She did a terrible sin, having this kind of relationship with her father, but the intent behind it was the mitzvah of saving the world. She didn't feel like doing this thing. She realized how negative it was, but she felt that it was up to her to save the world now, not just the future of the world. In fact, what actually happened was she bore the seed of the Mashiach from that. She really did. Out of that act that she did, that's so negative, actually what happened was she really saved the world. Not because there weren't any other men around that they could get married to, but actually what happened, because she thought that what happened was she became pregnant with a seed of a child that actually became the Mashiach. Became an incredible thing. So you see, there must have been truth in what she was doing. That she merited such a result from such a... And the Gemara says that what she did was a sin that was greater, a sin for the right reason is greater than a mitzvah that's for your own vested interest. Now, let's try and understand the subject. Let's start like this. The problem with this, why is it difficult? The difficulty is as follows. We see we have a principle in Torah that you're never allowed to do wrong means to get to the right end. That's the principle. You're not allowed to... You can't justify the means because you think that, well... Normally these means are not, you know, are not acceptable. So, but now you can do these means, which are not acceptable, because you see that the end point is justified. You're not allowed to make such calculations, normally. Why? Because the concept is that Hashem, the deep concept behind it is this. Hashem knows what he's doing. He knows what prohibitions he's put in the world and what consequences he needs. And he knows that if one day he will need you to achieve a certain end, but in your way he has put certain obstacles. And he has made the obstacles absolute. He knows that you can't get there from here because he's put the obstacles in the way. So who are you to suddenly start deciding that he actually made a mistake? That actually, well, yes, he didn't account for this situation, and therefore here he actually doesn't want me to respect these obstacles. We don't do that. Our approach to that is Hashem in his great wisdom knows that if he wants me to get from here to there, and between here and there, he has placed an obstacle which he says I'm not allowed to do, it's his problem. You follow? I'm not responsible for that mitzvah at the end of the day that I think he wants. He'll handle, it's his problem. He's big enough to run his world. I don't have to, there's a limit to what responsibility I have to take for myself. You follow me? The mashal, I'll just give you two ways of understanding it, but people who talk about this, they give two examples, two mashalim. One mashal is, if a person owns a business, and he hires an employee, and he says to him, listen, I want you to obey the following rules. Okay, you run the business like this and like this. When a customer comes in, I want you to handle it like this and like this and like this. Now one day, and those are the rules. Now one day, a customer comes in, and he offers a deal to this employee that goes against the rules that the employer says. But the problem is, this employee sees that he could make a fortune for his employer. He could really do well. He could make a very big deal over here. The only thing is, he has to do the business in a way that his employer told him not to do. The way a Jew should approach that situation is, you definitely don't do the deal. It's not your business. It's not your business. He didn't employ you here to make a fortune for him. He employed you on condition that you observe these and these rules. You follow? If that's the way he wanted the rules observed, who are you to start justifying what actually you think he really would want in this situation? You just can't go beyond the brief that you've been given. Are you with me? So at the end of the day, you have to say, look, I'm sorry, I didn't do the deal. You know, I'm not responsible. That's beyond the level of responsibility that I've been given. In many cases, there's a very moving account in Chazal of how when the Babylonians destroyed the temple, the Kohanim ran in and they threw the keys up to Shemayim. And it actually says they hadn't accepted them. Because they said, Hashem, you've entrusted us with the keys of this place. We are the Kohanim, we're in charge, we run things now. At this point, we can't function anymore. They were being overrun and destroyed. We can't function anymore. It's your problem. Here you are, here are the keys. We've done a loyal service up to now, okay? From here on in, you know, our job has come to an end. There's no more we can do. It's over to you. You don't start making calculations how actually you can turn around this situation. When you start making calculations is when you go wrong. I once told you the story, and I'll repeat it again, that Rabbi Chanani said to have told. I actually heard it from his son. He told the following story about when Hashem gives rules, a brilliant, incredible story. If you've heard it, it's worth repeating. How when Hashem gives you rules, you observe the rules. You don't start making calculations about actually you're smarter than he is, and you know that actually... You don't do that. He gave you rules, you follow the rules. You start making calculations, and it says that was the sin of Adam and Eve, actually. That actually was their sin. Their sin was they started making calculations. We discussed this a week ago, no? How actually they could do better than what Hashem said, because actually that's what he really wanted, although they didn't quite say it. They had a whole rationale that they used their own intellect, and that's where they made a big mistake. The story is like this, to show you that you don't make your own calculations. You do as you're told when somebody's wiser than you. The story is beautiful, beautiful marshal of a king who had a servant, a minister, in his court, one of the courtiers who was a trusted friend of his. One day this friend came to the king and told him that he wanted to go that evening to a banquet that the nobles were arranging. So the king said to him, fine, I don't mind, you can go to that banquet, but on one condition, no bets. Lay no bets, no wages. That's the condition. So the man said, fine. So he went, next day he came back, and the king said to him, how was the party? So he said, fine. So the king said to him, do you lay any bets? So he said, Your Majesty, just one. But I'll tell you what happened. When you hear what an easy win it was, definitely you'll approve. Definitely, you'll see. What happened was this. I walked into the banquet, and all the noblemen gathered around me, and they offered to take me on a bet for 50,000 rubles that I've got a hunchback. Now, I've got no hunchback. What could be easier than this? So I rolled up my shirt, and I collected 50,000 rubles. What's the problem? So the king said, you fool. They took me on a bet for 100,000 rubles that they could make you roll up your shirt in public. In other words, don't get clever. You're given rules. He knows the whole situation. He knows what's behind it all. You do as you're told. Now, with that background, we can begin to understand the problem. So now you want a Jew to do an Avera Lishma. You put a Jew in a situation. You follow what's going on now. So now imagine the ordeal of those girls. Here are these girls. They're sitting in the cave. They're talking to you. Just imagine that. They've just seen their mother turned into a pillar of salt. Because she couldn't even look at the destruction of the world. Right? An incredible cataclysmic catastrophe happened that the world was wiped out. And three people are left alive. That's what it seemed like to them. Now the girls are discussing it. Imagine, what would you do in such a situation? Imagine the ordeal. So they say to each other like this. Look, normally when Hashem gives rules, we've got no right to transgress the rules. Because he knows what he's doing. It's his problem. On the other hand, maybe he's giving us a tremendous ordeal over here. Maybe he wants to force ourselves into a thing that normally is a very offensive thing, but because after all he created the world to be people, he created the world that there should be people here on earth. You follow what's going on? Imagine the ordeal. So they decided this one. Now, and there are circumstances, of course, if you really want to make it difficult, you have to keep both things in your head at once. You have to know that normally you can't justify the means to do the end, because that's the way Hashem says it. But then you know there's a thing called Avera Lishma. You know that there are certain categories, very rarely, when Hashem sets up things, that He wants you to do what's wrong now in order to do what's right. Why does He do that? Because only that level of difficulty... Again. Because only that level of difficulty could be a genuine ordeal for somebody at that level. You see, somebody... are you with me? Imagine somebody was very highly trained spiritually and in total control, and Hashem gave them an enormous end result that they could have through a wrong means. They wouldn't have any problem. Definitely, it's not my business. I'm not allowed to do that. Wouldn't even be an ordeal. But the reason it becomes an ordeal is because they know that, but they also know that there are rare occasions in the history of the world when Hashem has a thing called Avera Lishma. Now the problem is this one of them or not? You hear the difficulty? That's the problem. Now let's try and examine it. Let's try and see. The times when you have this are the cases where the Gemara uses this principle. There are three women that have to be studied in this context. Now, I'm sure you're ahead of me already, you know who they are. One is the daughter or daughters of Lot. One is Esther, because Esther had to go and have a relationship with a non-Jew, with a king, in order to save the Jewish people. And not only that, but she had to do it voluntarily. We'll try and discuss this. Again, it's difficult to go into details. I'm not prepared to go into the exact graphic details. But I'll tell you enough that you can understand the subject. Got to get somebody who's more knowledgeable, a woman maybe, if you want to go into the details. Study the sources. It's fantastic to look to see. But I'll tell you enough you can understand. And the third woman, of course, is Yael. You know the story of Yael? You should know. Yael was a very great woman who committed a sin as a married woman with a man in order to save the Jewish people. And the Gemara says was a Avera Lishma. Let's try and understand. Let's approach it this way. You see, Esther was in a situation where she was taken by a non-Jewish king. He didn't know that she was married. I presume you all know she was married to Mordechai. She was married to Mordechai. It says the word, the Megillah uses the word bat, which means she was his daughter, but the Mephoshim says it means bait, actually. It means his wife. Because the bait means a home, and a woman is always described as being a man's home. She's the place, she provides the place where he is. If you want to know how deep that goes, we spoke about it last night, the subject of marriage. You don't need to hear it, just need to give the cassette to your husband. But the thing is, so she was married to him. Now the problem was that if she's going to go and have a relationship with a non-Jew, that's one of the three things that a person has to give their life rather than do. To have a relationship with somebody, if a married woman, a married Jewish woman, a married woman, has a relationship, intimate relationship with somebody other than her husband, first of all, she has to give her life rather than do that. And secondly, she's forbidden thereafter forever to her husband and to the man. There are opinions that even if he's not Jewish, she's forbidden to him, even if he would convert to Judaism later, she'd still be forbidden to him for the rest of her life, but certainly to her husband. And for that, not only is she forbidden to her husband, she has to die rather than do that. It's one of three sins that you have to die for. As I'm sure you're aware, there are everything in the Torah you have to transgress rather than die, except for three things: idolatry, murder, and sexual immorality. Those three things you have to give your life rather than do. But the complication is this. The Gemara has a long discussion of this question. Now, I don't feel capable here of going into the exact... The details are too intimate here. This is not the forum to go into. But generally the idea is like this. The Gemara says that whether or not you have to die rather than commit this sort of sin depends on whether you're a man or a woman. Because it makes a difference whether you are actually the active party, whether you initiate this sin and you're the active party, or whether you're the passive party. In other words, let's understand carefully. If a woman would be raped, that means not she's not active at all. She's forced against her will into such a thing, she doesn't have to die for it. She doesn't have to die. The woman says, the Gemara says, because a woman's called Karka Olam, a long halakhic discussion which I don't feel capable of going to here. But the point is that, so therefore, now let's understand, it means this. Let's take a case. The Gemara says, let's say they take a man, and they say to him, let's leave out the sexual area, let's take the area of murder. The Gemara says, if they take a man and they say to him, kill somebody else or we'll kill you, he's not allowed to kill that other person, because who's he to say that his blood is redder than that man's? And therefore he has to die. There's a lot of details here. Of course he can kill the assailant in self-defense, I'm not going into all that now. But rather than kill somebody else, he has to die. But what happens if they pick him up and they want to use him as a murder weapon? You have the problem? What happens if these strange, perverted individuals, they say to a man, not you kill somebody else, a person has to die rather than commit an act of murder. But does he have to die in order to stop an act of murder being committed that they're going to use him in? They're not, it says not. Whether you're allowed to do such a thing for Kiddush Hashem, to save people, to save a lot of people, is another discussion. Now, if it's a case of this sin with a man and a woman, then the Gemara says like this: a man always has to die, and I'm not prepared to go into why now. You have to ask your husband or discuss it some other time in private. But a man always has to die rather than do it for certain reasons. But a woman not. A woman depends. If she's raped, she should rather do that. Be raped than give up her life. On the contrary, probably forbidden to die in such a situation. But if she has to initiate the relationship, so then she's just as much culpable as a man, and she has to die rather than do that. Now, the problem with Esther was this, that when she was taken by Ahasuerus, she was raped. She had no control over the situation. She was taken by the king. The faintest flicker of refusal would have amounted to summary execution. And therefore, every time she was taken by him for purposes of this immoral relationship, so she didn't have to die. And therefore, she was, first of all, didn't have to die. And second of all, when this terrible ordeal was over, she would be allowed back to her husband. The problem arose one day when she had to approach the king. You remember when the decree was made against the Jewish people, she now had to go and appear before the king. Now that is a very different story, because if she would then appear before him, and then he would want to have to engage in a relationship with her, now that she hadn't been with him for months at this, he hadn't called her for a long time, now she would be guilty of being the one who initiated the relationship, and for that you rather have to die. And not only that, but even if it would be an Avera Lishma, then she'd still be forbidden to her husband after that. And therefore she said the famous words, V'kasher avadati avadati. Just as I am lost, I am lost. Why did she say the words twice? Because it means just as I'm really lost, I'm lost to you also, my husband, she said to Mordechai. When he said that you have to go and do this thing, she said, but from now on our marriage is over. Because now that I'm the actor, you hear that, there's a long discussion here why the Jewish people had to be saved in such a disgraceful way. Actually, it's because of our infidelity towards our husband, Hashem. So Hashem taught us the message of saving our lives through having the disgrace of a Jewish woman. It's a very, very deep and beautiful thing to understand. Anyway, that's not the point now. So therefore, that was the problem. Now, and there's a debate, halachically, whether she was permitted to Mordechai afterwards, whether she wasn't. According to many opinions, she had to stay with Ahasuerus. She had a child by him. 2 generations later, the child came out of that called Koresh. Cyrus, in English, is called Darius II. He allowed the Jews to go back to Babel, build the second temple. And be that as it may. But she had to do this thing with a man she called a dog. She called him a dog. She criticized for doing that. That's what happened. Now, what happened with Yael was the following thing. So, you see, those were the elements over here. Now, she had to do this sin. She had to do this thing, but it was to save the Jewish people. Nobody criticized Esther. She had to do it. She had to do this thing, even though she was the active party, which means that she had to do something that was against the Torah, but it was in order to save the Jewish people. But it took tremendous greatness to have to make that decision. Now, in the case of Yael, this is what happened. And this is illustrated most clearly. Yael was a woman who was married to a man called Chever HaKen. She was a married woman, and she lived in a certain place, where the people, actually it so happens that at the time it was women who ran everything. That's, not that they don't always, just here it was, here it just was that it was explicit. Normally women do it from behind the scenes. But here it was done explicitly. The person who led the Jewish people at the time was Devorah, the prophetess, the judge, Devorah. And she had the general Avinoam ben Barak, who was the general of the army, and together they defeated the enemies of the Jews, led by a man called Sisera, in a miraculous, they had a very clever strategy. They defeated the enemy, but the problem was that Sisera escaped, and he was a threat to the existence of the Jewish people, and they couldn't catch him. And Sisera ran past the tent of Yael. And Yael realized that if she could stop him, she could save the Jewish people. But how could a woman stop a man? How was she going to stop him? So this is what happened. This is what happened. The Gemara says that he stopped at the tent, and he said that he was going to rest inside. He was exhausted. And she should stay by the entrance to the tent and say if any man approached. So, and he was very thirsty. So he asked for water, and she gave him, I think, milk, or she first gave him cheese to make him even thirstier, then she gave him milk. And when he fell asleep, she drove the tent peg through his head. She nailed his head to the ground to finish him off, and by the time Zipporah and Barak, or Barak and his men, caught up with him, there was Sisera. Yes, not, no longer in this dimension. Yeah. Now, that's what it says in Tanakh. But the problem is, if you read the words carefully, you'll see that's not all that happened. And if you read the words of Devorah carefully, it's almost explicit what happened over there. I'm not prepared to go into it. Ask somebody who can read the words for you. Look it up in Tanakh. Look up Rashi. It's quite open over there. But what happened was, just very brief, I can just give you the outline. What happened was this. When you read what she did, it says that this great woman, he asked for water, she gave him milk and so forth. But when it comes to the song of Devorah, a beautiful, beautiful song, when Devorah sings the praises of Yael, she's very explicit about what happened over there. You don't need too much reading between, you don't need to be an English major, you know, when you read the words in Tanakh or whatever it is, to understand what happened. Actually, what happened was she committed a sin with him. How exactly is very interesting. I'm not, that I'm certainly not prepared to tell you. can look it up yourself. It's actually mind-boggling. But anyway, the point is that's what she did. And that is how she was able to kill him. Because that brought him to a situation where she was in control of him, exhausted, as she killed him. Now, the problem was that she was in a situation where she had to save the Jewish people, but the problem was she had to be the active party. She had to initiate this. And she was a married woman. So the Gemara says that was the case of a Baruch Nishma. She had to do a sin for Hashem's sake in order to achieve this great, and it was the only means at her disposal. And she was great enough to decide that that's what Hashem required at that time. Now, finally, there's just one detail that needs to be said to wrap it up. When Reb Chaim Shmulevitz used to give this talk, when he used to explain the subject, he used to always say the following thing. How does a person know whether you're allowed to do this thing or not? What's the general guideline whether you can do this Avera Lishma or not? So he said, the general guideline is like this. Before you're even allowed to consider it, you have to answer one question. Is there any pleasure or vested interest in it for me? If there is, the whole thing's possible. That's absolutely not allowed. There's no further discussion. You throw the keys up, you give them back to Hashem. It's his problem. Only if you can, you see, because otherwise you can't trust yourself. Because if you're going to go into this sin now, okay, and actually it's got a long-term benefit, that's fantastic. But actually along the way, you're going to get benefit out of this, no matter how small. You're not objective anymore. You're not thinking about Hashem's benefit in the end now. You're thinking about what, and therefore if there's any pleasure at all, or any vested interest, or any benefit in any way whatsoever, it's absolutely out of the question. And therefore, we are no longer capable of, we can't do things. All sins, by the way. All sins. Okay, you think of a sin that doesn't have some vested interest. Otherwise, why would it be? Wouldn't be prohibited otherwise. You follow? Shem wouldn't bother to prohibit things, generally speaking, unless you have a tendency to want to do this. And therefore, there's always that vested interest in it. People are no longer on a level. I'll tell you very briefly, we've got 1 minute left. I'll tell you very briefly that there were people on a level where they could have such control that they could do things that were very pleasurable, and be so divorced from the experience by sheer power of their will that the Torah actually made it an obligation. The classic example I'm thinking of is Yibum. Just to illustrate the point, you know that the Torah law is that when a man dies without children, his brother has to marry his widow. Now normally to marry a brother's wife is a terrible prohibition in Torah. But only in these particular circumstances where there's a brother and there's no children and certain other requirements are met, he's allowed to marry the woman. If he can't marry her, for some reason he has to do the alternative ceremony of Chalitza. Today we only do Chalitza, we never do this marriage. Why? Why did Rabbeinu Gershom in the 10th century or 11th century, why did he pass this law that from now on we don't do Yibum? It's a mitzvah of the Torah. For the following fascinating reason. Because one of the preconditions for Yibum is that when this man marries this woman who normally is forbidden to him, it says, Lahakim Shem Alachim, to raise a name for his brother. To have a child that will be his brother's name. Actually, in the mystical writings it talks about a reincarnation of the brother. That's another subject. But that's what it is. But it means that his only motivation has to be to bring a child into the world for his brother. If he likes the woman at all, he's not allowed to do it. That means if there's any, do you follow this? That means if there's any vested interest here, it's invalid. You understand that the Torah requires of a Jewish man, you hear this? The Torah requires of a Jewish couple to be able to be engaged in such a relationship with such purity of mind that they're actually completely divorced from the experience and only for the spiritual purpose of having a child. So Rabbi Gershom came along in the 10th century and he said, gentlemen, from now on, take it from me, we are not capable. And therefore we can't fulfill the mitzvah according to the way it's supposed to be, and therefore it's a prohibition, and from now on we're not allowed to do. But you see, now, with Yael, the Chaim used to say the following thing. If you feel anything, this thing's prohibited. So how could Yael do this? Yael did. The same question applies by Lot and his daughters. But by Yael is where he said it. With Yael, she had to do a sin with a man that definitely is in that category. So he answered like this. For a woman like Yael, a tzaddikus like that, that's not called special. For a woman at that level of greatness, it was a disgusting and painful experience from beginning to end. It was such a belittling and humiliating and painful experience that it was well within the reach of her control, do you follow? To be called something that we should... In other words, to be called something where there's no vested interest. That's what it is. That's the summary of the discussion. In other words, there's a thing called Avera Lishma. It's only relevant if you can truthfully say you're on a level where this sin is absolutely meaningless to you. It's completely abhorrent to you. You think it's only to serve Hashem to get to the end result, which is what he wants. In such circumstances, at certain level of greatness, which we're not capable of judging anymore, there is a thing called Avera Lishma. And those are the three areas that Reb Chaim used to say, and with this discussion, I hope we can understand a bit more why nothing else is difficult. The rest of the Torah is easy. You got your instructions, you do them. Through fire, through water, you do it. This is the difficulty.